This week's conversation with Michelle Anae Morgan of Mutually Assured Deconstruction is sponsored by Sassy Jack's Stitchery. Kim and the folks at Sassy Jack's are getting ready to open their new Forever Home this fall, and the latest report is the opening will be soon. They're down to putting knobs and latches on doors. Be sure to check out the full collection of Sassafras sampler charts, including Alice Ellen Usher, 1873, Christian Henry, 1816, and Elizabeth Cooper, Jesus Wept. Many of the Sassafras charts are available as PDF downloads, and Kim will be happy to put together kits for all of them. Make Sassy Jack Stitchery your local needlework store by visiting the website at sassyjackstitchery.com and plan to visit when the new shop opens this fall. In addition, Sassy Jacks will be sponsoring the Wednesday night Stitch Hour this week, October 12, when Michelle Morgan joins us live to talk about her outstanding art. Don't miss it at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern on the Fiber Talk YouTube channel. And now, on to our conversation with Michelle Anae Morgan. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr, and you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week from Mutually Assured Deconstruction, Michelle Anae Morgan. Michelle, welcome.
Thank you, Gary. Thanks for having me. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks for doing it. All right, we can't just walk right by that. Mutually Assured Deconstruction. I love it.
Sure. So back when Instagram was not as big as it was, I had a kind of silly name, and then I decided to change it to an equally silly name, and this is what I came up with. And since that time, I went viral, and so I feel like I'm kind of stuck with it because that's how people know me now, even though it was sort of a flash in the pan decision at the time. This was before I even started embroidering. So, you know, I grew up in the 80s, and Mutually Assured Destruction was a thing, and then I went to grad school and I got a PhD in in American studies, specializing in visual and material culture. And deconstruction is, you know, a sort of theoretical framework for thinking through how we interact with different kinds of cultural objects. And so I was playing off from that and thinking, oh, I should be Mutually Assured Deconstruction, which was just kind of a nerdy, very niche username. And then I went viral for embroidery stuff, and now I'm just kind of known by that. So there it is. That's my name.
Yeah, don't give it up. It's excellent.
Thank you.
and there's something about the words MAD also. Yeah. There's a whole thing there. Don't give it up.
I love that too. Yes, definitely Matt.
Yep. I did want to ask you, now you work at Yale University and have your 5x7 business card of functions, but I was curious about the digital accessibility consultant part. And then in one spot in my research, you actually had a click-on thing where we could hear your name spoken.
Yes.
Tell me about that digital accessibility. That sounds like a fascinating and useful area.
Yeah. So when I finished my PhD, I had a teenager and I wasn't really looking to become a professor and move around the country looking for a job. I really had to stay local. And I was working a term position at our Center for Teaching and Learning at Yale. And accessibility is really thinking about the ways that people with disabilities use the internet, digital accessibility. And so there was a bunch of lawsuits. I mean, I'm trying to give you the abbreviated version so I can even explain what it is. But there were a lot of lawsuits and changes to the laws in the last 10 years around the internet, because when the internet started, people who had disabilities in the ADA weren't really there was no internet when that was passed in 1990. So over the years, we've had to rethink what it means to have like a place of public accommodation, how people with disabilities use the internet. It's the modern storefront. You don't really go to Domino's and like order a pizza anymore or call them. You use the internet to do it. And so digital accessibility is really thinking through how do people with disabilities use the internet? And by extension, how do they use the kinds of things we post on our websites, et cetera? And so that's also a concern in teaching, of course, as more and more teaching is digitized. How do we make sure that our students are able to interact with all of the things that we post online, whether they have a mobility concern or a visual impairment, or if they are deaf or hard of hearing? Some students, you know, can't use a mouse. So how do they interact with a course website if they can't click on something? Can they use it entirely with their keyboard? So I got really involved with those efforts and then got lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time for a job in digital accessibility at Yale. So I mostly consult with faculty and staff about how to make sure that everything that they're producing and distributing can be used by people with disabilities. And I love it. It's not that far. Like, I think about my art practice and the things I studied as a PhD student, where I was really interested in how people get information about the world based on the things that they make with their hands. And this really isn't that far removed from that. It's just thinking about how people get information when they're using a sense other than sight, which we're really used to depending on.
Yeah, you really got my wheels spinning when I saw that title, and then here's how my name is pronounced, you know, audio.
Oh yeah.
Simple things like that just to those of us who don't have any disabilities just, you know, don't even enter our minds.
Yep.
But yeah, then my mind started going, oh, wait a minute, I can see where this is pretty valuable stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, and the Name Coach, that's a tool that we use mostly because we also have students from all over the world. Mm-hmm. And it can be really frustrating for them to have to repeatedly explain to people how to say their name over and over again. And people want to make sure that they're honoring and getting that right, that they're able to pronounce people's names correctly. So if a faculty member has access to how all the students say their names, then that's just a better environment all around for everybody.
Yeah, and that sounds like a very hands-on function, a job function to...
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, always learning. Excellent.
Yes.
Yeah, and that was the other part. You know, you mentioned about embroidery and everything that you do. It seems like embroidery is tied in somehow or has an adjunct role or meaning, and it's most interesting. And so you picked up, but now you're not a lifelong embroiderer.
I'm
but,
not.
but fairly recent. But it's your family have an art and craft background?
So totally, yes. So I have in my like little artist statement on my website, what I say is that I was born into a family of people who make things with their hands and, you know, a very working class rural background where my mom's family and my dad's, both, most of the men were either carpenters or welders, worked in the shipbuilding industry up there at Bath Iron Works. All of my, you know, my mom loves to sew. There's just a like sort of practical working aspect to their craft, but they're also like extremely talented. Like my mom's father was a welder at Bath Iron Works, but he made like belt buckles and rings and like these just amazing, like small intricate objects, even, you know, by welding. And so my dad was a carpenter and my family, ran a really small family lumber company. But he was a master carpenter. He, you know, built and designed kitchens and like drew blueprints without any education. He only went to high school. And so I definitely come from people who just need to make things, and valued like that things could be both work and art.
It's in the genes.
It really is. Yeah. Yeah. And so I did come to it later in life. I was finishing my PhD and I had a really hard time. Like most grad students, I just could not get through the dissertation. I was bored and frustrated. And I was like, what am I doing? I can't finish anything. So, I sort of picked up embroidery as a way to like tap into that side of my brain. Cause I kind of just like went to grad school and thought, oh, I won't have time to make anything. And that was really not a good choice for me. Like I have to make things or I get depressed.
It gives you the outlet. Was it the escape? The
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, before I went to graduate school, before I went to Yale, I was living in Maine and I was, really actively like making things. So I used to do a lot of cut paper. I used to do a lot of mixed media. I was not a full-time artist. Like I've never made, you know, a primary living by doing that. But I got into Yale and I'm a first generation college student. So I didn't really have a lot of models for what it was going to look like to be at an institution like that. And some place so elite. And I was really scared that I wouldn't be able to keep up with all of the work. So when we moved from Maine to Connecticut, I just like sold all my art supplies. I got rid of everything. I was like, I'm not going to have time to do this. I'm really going to need to focus on my studies. And that was just not a good idea. This was just not how I'm built, not how I'm wired. So I went through the first few years of graduate school. And, you know, I did fine in school, but I was just not happy. I was drinking a lot. So we can talk about that part, too. Like, I definitely identify as an alcoholic. My whole family is, they're all alcoholics. As I was getting near the end of graduate school, I just knew that, like, I had to be making things. And so I picked up first a cross stitch, like my, I was dating this person, this woman who gave me a cross stitch kit as like a joke, in my Christmas stocking. And I did it and it was just so soothing that I just started doing cross stitch all the time. And then as I was probably just over the course of a couple months, I decided I needed to quit drinking. And I was realizing, as I was looking at things online, I was like, oh, I could do that. I could make that. Not just cross-stitch stuff, but more embroidery work. And so I just kind of like threw myself into it and it gave me everything I needed. It just like soothed my brain. It calmed me down. And I finished my dissertation like pretty quickly after that. Like just kind of made all the pieces click again, I think, in my brain. Like trying to divorce the creative from the like thinking side of my life just did not work for me.
So do you wonder if you hadn't gotten rid of all your arts and crafts things before you went to school, if that had, would have made life easier all along? Or
I do. I think about it a lot. I think that it absolutely would have. I also think like there was just some insecurity about going to Yale that made me like I had to figure that out. You know, like making the decision between being an artist or being like a person who dedicates herself to academia was something I just had to figure out. And I'm not sure I would have been able to figure it out if I hadn't done that. So I don't really have any regrets. I just think like when you go to a school like Yale, people are so committed to like, I'm going to be a historian of this topic and I'm going to for the rest of my life and I'm not going to do anything else and that's all I can do. And so I just can't live like that. I have too many interests and making art and embroidering especially is just, I cannot not have that. I have to have it. Yeah.
Yeah. You are multidimensional. There is no question about that. Right. You got it all going on, but that's, you know, it's interesting. So that, because we've had so many shows where we've talked about the role of needlework in whatever form mm-hmm. as a meditative process, as a therapeutic thing, you know, an escape, yeah. a tension reliever. We've had so many people talk about how, you know, they sit down to stitch and their body just, it just all flows out of them and they relax and enter another world. And so that's what it did for you. It allowed you to relax and
It's really like it slows you down. Like you are forced to slow down. You can't, like, even with drawing or painting, like you can make a mark really fast. And I'm not saying that any of those things are quick mediums because people work for, you know, years on right. stuff, but embroidery is like, you are not going to get very far, very fast. So just the form itself is a slow form. So, you know, artists will talk about entering that like space, right, where they lose all sense of time and everything kind of just shuts down and they're just in the art zone. But with embroidery, it's like that on top of like, you're just not going to get a quick result.
Right.
Like,
so. Right.
I found that really, really useful for me, for sure.
That's really neat. But the thing that is, you know, let's talk about your alcoholism and and depression. And so embroidery helped you with all of these things then.
It totally did. I think also like it, for me at least, and I think the history of needlework in general, like there throughout history for women, especially, it's just been like a form of storytelling and narrative. And so it allowed me to like explore themes and topics and my past. I don't always do like super biographical stuff, but I have done a ton of biographical stuff too. But it allows me to like explore the stories that I tell myself about my history over and over again in a really different way than just like talking about it or writing it down with words. You know, like they're like little memoirs of sorts. And that I think is interesting to me because it's so in line with like the history of needlework and samplers and like, you know, tapestries, just like how our stories get told through these visual images that take so long to tell, but are also like very accessible in terms of materials and maybe not time, but certainly material and cost. So like one of the things for me was like, I was also a broke graduate student who was like a single mom with a teenager who didn't have any money. And like,
that's an ugly combination there. Holy smokes.
Right? Yeah. So buying art supplies is expensive. And for, you know, it's very easy to get into cross stitch and embroidery on an extreme budget. So like I was able to do things and then sell them. People would buy them and it helped me like make a little bit of extra money too. So it was always kind of a like relief because I knew I could do something that would make me feel better. But then like people would buy these things and it would help me pay the bills and put groceries on the table.
So, yeah. Those basics. Yes.
Yeah, the basics.
Well, the one piece you did, your relationship with alcohol, I mean, when I look at that, you look at it as a whole, but then you have on your website several close-up segments, sections, and I can see the therapy there.
Oh, totally. That was such a, like, really intense piece for me to make. Like, so now I've been sober for 7.5 years, so for a significant chunk of time. When I started that, I don't remember even what year it was, but maybe about 3 years ago, 4 years ago. And, you know, like my family is not shy about the fact that they're all alcoholics. Like they're, you know, when I say that, I'm not like airing anything that anybody who knows my family doesn't or is not already aware of, including the people in my family. And a lot of people have just passed away too now, like as I get older. But I think like I grew up like most people do who are in limited education, working class families who drink a lot, that like it wasn't an issue ever. Like you just drank. That was just what you do. And you still have a job. You're functional, if whatever that means. I kind of hate the idea of being a functional alcoholic just because much dysfunction happens within whatever that supposedly functional thing is. But I had like a long, really difficult process of coming out as gay, and a lot of like family trauma stuff happened around that. My father died and my dad was really, really important to me. He was like the family person who I counted on emotionally. I was really close to him and he basically raised me. I lived with him for most of my childhood and he passed away very suddenly. He was only 45 and he had epilepsy. And like I was coming out at the same time and like I had a baby and like I was seeing his dad and it was just like just a bad time. I was very young when I had my son and I wasn't equipped to deal with everything. And so over the years, I just had so much guilt. And then you like abuse substances on top of that. And you're kind of making it in the world, but like the guilt. And so that piece was really important to me as far as like just kind of excising all of those demons and like being brutally honest. Like I put things on there that I was like, this is me, like, in like AA and in recovery circles, like there's a saying that you're only as sick as your secrets. And I love that saying. And so just being like, I'm going to do this piece and I'm going to tell the truth about everything that I've done, good and bad. And if you don't have any secrets, then that is really freeing. So that piece allowed me to do that and just say things on the internet to a random group of strangers, you know, like these are the worst things that I've done.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't pull any punches in that piece. No,
no, no, I don't. And it was really, really, I mean, I'm in my 40s and, you know, I've been in therapy a long time and I'm not like worried about anything making me so upset. Like, I'm fine. I'm, you know, but like, I wanted, I think, to be able to say, like, these are the hardest things that I've been through, because when other people do that, like, it made it okay for me to get help for my drinking. And so it's also just a sort of like invitation to people to not be ashamed of themselves and to get help if they need it, which is really, really important to me.
Yeah. Boy, life really piled it on you there in a short time. That's too bad. Yeah.
Yeah. It was rough in my early 20s, but you know, whatever. People, not whatever, but not to rank, you know, hardships, but like,
right.
I'm lucky in a lot of ways too. I had a lot of resources available. So
yeah, you can always find someone who's got it worse.
Yeah, you can.
Every day, every day. Like, yep. Exactly. Yep. Exactly. So when you do pieces like that, is it an immediate release for you? Is it, and this is a bad word given what we've just talked about, but is it like a drug where you need to keep doing it because it keeps helping you?
Totally. I think that's actually a really smart way of framing it, because, you know, I've, and this is more like recovery world talk, but it's like you give up one addiction for another, and definitely like the feel good ness of just being in a piece and like making artwork where it's like, I want more of this feeling. Right. And I do have to keep doing it. I get obsessed, obsessive about it. And so there have been times in my life where like I had this one job that was a really intense job that I knew was just short term when I started embroidering, where I was like, again, I have to like not have my embroidery stuff around, kind of like when I decided to go to grad school, where I was like, I have to focus on this. And if I have embroidery around, I'm addicted to it, right? Like, I'm not going to be able to put it down.
Yeah.
And so I have to make like really strong decisions sometimes on like, I'm going to this place and I'm not bringing my bag with me with my stuff. Like, I'm just going to like go and be present with the people there and not be like embroidering through it. Other times I'm like, whatever, we're hanging around a fire or something, you know, I'm going to not at night, but like we're hanging around outside and we're going to be sitting around in a circle all day. I'm bringing my craft with me, but
yeah,
I have to make decisions about it for sure, but I'm totally okay with that. Whatever. As far as I'm concerned, that's fine.
Knitters do it all the time.
Yeah.
it's no different. They do it all the time. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then and I'm sorry, I'm not going to get the terms right sooner or later, so I apologize right up front.
Don't let it hold you up.
but you know, the fact that you're gay and your expressions in that channel of your life, or that, you know, it is your life, but I mean, you know what I mean, that aspect, it's helped you there too, because you had a rough time dealing with that when you came out.
Yes. So,
or others had a rough time dealing with it.
Yeah. I think like it was a combination. I think like I was extremely sensitive to other people's responses because it took so much work to come out. Like, and I don't want to be like, oh, kids have it easy these days. They don't. There are plenty of places, as we know, across the country where it is just atrocious and worse than ever. But at the time, it was just really, really hard. I didn't have any role models at all for that. I didn't know anybody who was out. Nobody was out in high school. People just didn't come out.
Yeah.
Even the people who were out, like I had a friend whose mom was a lesbian, and she and her partner were like just friends. And like my stepmother, who's a hairdresser, did their hair. And we would debate, like, are they? And it's like, now, you know, looking back, I'm like, are you kidding me? Of course they were lesbians. At the time, like, just no idea what that would look like as a life for myself.
Right.
And I had my son really young with his dad, who I had known since I was just a little kid, and just no models for that. And so probably not at all surprisingly now, when I think back to it, my mom's side of the family, I thought were going to be more upset about it because they were very Catholic, but like Catholics are some of the most like closet ridden people in the world. So they actually were way chiller. There's like way more dirty history on that side of the family. And then they're like, oh girl, you're gay. That's nothing. But my dad's side of the family that I was a lot closer to and that weren't religious, but were like very, very Yankee Protestant, like now like libertarian and Trump conservatives. But like at the time, like they just could not abide that.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandmother, who I was very, very close to, like it was just a really bad time. And my dad died suddenly. And so I just kind of had like no real sort of inroad with that side of the family.
You lost your rock at the worst time. Yeah.
Right. So it just sucked. And then I did, you know, I moved away from my son. I left him with his dad and like had a girlfriend in Columbus, Ohio, and she'd been a professor. I mean, it's all in the pieces. So, and all this is in my embroidery works about the alcohol piece, especially. But it was really difficult. And so, at the time, like I wasn't doing needlework. But at the time I definitely was like doing a lot of cut paper and like still like really small intricate things where you have to like piece things together very carefully. And then, so now, I think of my pieces and its relationship to like my sexuality as being very much ways to, again, sort of externalize the internal. And I do a lot of abstract pieces that I call like queer landscapes or, mostly those where I just kind of build like these layers and textures. And I try to think of like how dynamic that is for me, like my sexuality. Like I'm about as normie as they get when it comes to gay people. I am married to a white lesbian. I am a white lesbian. Like there's nothing that radical about anything that we do.
Yeah. Yeah.
But compared to like where I was growing up, like forget it, you know, like I could never imagine having this life. I joke a lot with my wife that I remember being probably about 21 or 22 and my son was about 2 and I was standing up looking out the window and I just could not imagine like, how do you even meet a woman that you would date, let alone like live that life? Like I could not imagine it. So.
Yeah. Different times. Yeah.
Very much different times.
Growing up. Yeah. I can identify instances, male and female, where boy, those two are really close. You know, they're really good friends. And because, you know, I'm young and stupid. Sure. What did I know? And,
well, I'm poor.
You know, wow, those guys really, man, they just do everything together. They're cool, you know? And you didn't, what did I know? And then later on, oh, yeah. Okay, got it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. You know, they're wearing the same ring. I go over and they're like sleeping in the same bedroom, but they're friends? Like, what on earth? But you just can't, I mean, it's such an open secret, but also just like so shameful. Like, you know, it's just ridiculous, especially in Maine. You know, I'm going to make stereotypical joke, but like all the women wear flannels and drive snowmobiles. Like what? You have no way to know.
Yeah. Yeah. But so, oh boy, I tell you, what a time in your life, you know, applause that you got through it and you're still in one piece.
My son is all, you know, he kept me going even when I didn't want to, because you gotta stay okay for your kid, if nothing else.
Yeah. Yeah. You'll do a lot. Yep. That's for sure. Now you mentioned the gay landscapes section and folks who are listening, You go to her website, Mutually Assured Deconstruction. I grew up when it was Mutually Assured Construction.
You know how many people look at it and they're like, wow, it took me 5 years to realize it doesn't say Mutually Assured Deconstruction. Now I can't do it the other way.
My whole childhood was the Cold War, so that's the that phrase is locked in.
Yeah.
But when we go to your website and it's the gay landscapes that stop me. I mean, I really enjoyed your art all the way through, but the gay landscapes are the ones that stop me, especially that black on black one. Holy smokes. Yeah. That thing is a stunning piece, but
thank you.
It really is. I'm not making this up or sucking up to you. It is absolutely a stunning piece. I have been back to that several times. It just, it's just everything is there.
Make another one. Honestly, now that when you mentioned it, I was like, wow, I haven't done one like that for a while. That would be like, so I think I'm going to make a new, now that, you know how it is, you come back around to things and
yeah,
I think it's time for another one.
Oh, well, that one right there for me, all your other stuff, yeah, fine over here, but right here, give me that black one. but your art, there's so much texture and depth all the way through it. And the materials, the different stitches, the threads, is this something that just comes to you in your head? Is it something that we don't see all the pieces you've thrown away?
No.
How has that come to be?
I almost never throw anything away. I think I probably have like 2 or 3 pieces in 8 years that I've abandoned. So I don't know. I mean, what happened was, like, as I started doing more embroidery was more of abstract pieces and sort of just like taking bits and pieces from, like, you know, I don't know, you're just walking around in the world and you see some like color or shape combination that strikes you. And so when I started embroidering, it was really just these little pieces that were snippets from things that interested me visually. And then I saw people, like, I didn't really start using beads till, I don't know, a few years in. I just started resenting the, like, sort of constrictions of, like, a floral piece that just had to be flowers, you know? Yeah. Like, sometimes I really love, like, I go back and forth. Like, I'll do something that's very representational because I like the limits and I want it to look like a thing. And then usually after I do a piece like that, I wind up doing one of the, like, queer landscape ones where I'm like, this is more, it's more abstract. There's no picture. It's just a, you know, shapes and colors and textures. And, cause I just like switching back and forth, but, those I build, I don't make any plan. I just do it. I like just kind of start with, sometimes I start with like a color palette. Usually I start with a color palette and I limit myself that way. Sometimes I like them to be just like completely rainbow multicolored. But usually I'll start with a color palette and I'll just go in and I just start building stitches and paying attention to, like, you would with any composition. Like, I have pink here, so I need to balance it out with some pink over here, and I'll just build them organically. I don't think about it at all. I just kind of go with the flow. So people have been like, oh, can you show me how to do that? Or do you have like a pattern or, you know, and I'm like, I wish I did. I sold them on the internet for $1 million and not. Just kidding. You know, nobody makes $1 million selling patterns, but
no.
but no, they're just very much like something that I've developed and use in between the more like narrative representational pieces that I tend to make.
Yeah, but they're in you. They come out of you, and yet, you know, clearly there's a composition. Knowledge there as you put, you know, in the end result, they're not just some random mess.
No, it's always color. I think it's just like an intuitive, you know, part of the artistry of needlework where it's like, I just know when I'm making something that, like, well, there's more texture over here. There's French knots over here. And I put some beads here and there's shiny beads here. So I need to balance it out by this over there. So I am paying attention absolutely to the composition of the piece. But I don't go in with any kind of like I mean, as far as the stitches are concerned, I just build them bit by bit.
Yeah.
I think that just comes with experience too. Like anybody, you know, who knows a couple of different stitches, you can like, I think it would be relatively simple for someone to do what make those works if they know how to embroider. I also tend to use like all six floss strands for those. So they're a little bit chunkier and the, you know, it's not as flat as when I'm embroidering other pieces. It tends to be just two strands.
Yeah. And your color palette in general is very rich and bold.
Yes.
I don't see much pastel anywhere.
Nope. I'm just, that's just my like preference.
That's,
I think,
you, huh?
Yep. Yep. I'm just like, you know, I'd say I'm a maximalist. I really am. Sometimes I do like tone it down, but not very often. Like, so I made, you know, I do rug tufting too. I just got into tufting rugs last year, and I have the same kind of really bold color palette. And then I tried to like tone it down for one rug, and I really liked the rug, and people are like, wow, that's really great. But like, it's one of the only ones I haven't sold. And I'm like, I try to tone it down. It doesn't come natural to me. It's not as effective, I guess. So
you speak about sold. What of your art do you sell, and what do you keep? Because there's no way you can let it go.
I'm not sentimental about it.
Okay. Because so, I find artists, when artists create things and sell, like I used to communicate with a person who was a scientific illustrator. She drew fish and birds and things exactly, you know, every feather just as it was. And then she would sell the original. She had prints made and sold those like crazy. But then she'd sell the original. And to me, it was, oh, how could you sell that beautiful thing? Because you poured so much into it. So it doesn't bother you.
No, people ask me this all the time. And like other artists too, they're like, oh, I just, not for sale. I'm having such a hard time parting with it. And I don't know. I think like not that all artists aren't like starving at some point, but like, I think I just got like really used to depending on it as secondary income. I think also like the part for me is really just like in the making of it. And it's really depressing when I see things like in the closet that I made 5 years ago. Like, I'm like, oh, I don't know. It's not being enjoyed. Like, so it just means so much to me that someone else will want to buy something and like they care about it, or they liked it or related enough to it to pay money for it, and like that it exists in their house, or that they give it as a gift, or like even if, you know, it winds up in their closet too, like there's just something so meaningful to me about that. Even though it's transactional, like that transaction is just so meaningful to me. Like it is so truly touching to me that someone would want to pay money for something that I've made, that like that means more to me than any attachment I have to the object because I made it.
Yeah.
So the alcohol piece I still have, and if someone wants to buy it, they can, like it's for sale, but I also, you know, that's still at my house, and I could see that becoming like a family thing that like my son has it eventually or whatever. But I would sell it because if it meant that much to someone that they liked it so much that they would pay money for it, then to me that is like the ultimate sort of meaning of art. Like, why do we do what we do? Why do we make these things? Like, if other people are enjoying them that much, then that to me is like the ultimate.
Yeah.
So
do you have your art hanging all over the house, or?
I don't know. No. The only, I have other people's art hanging all over my apartment, but the only piece that I have two pieces that I've made that are hanging up. One is the very first embroidery that I made, which I totally ripped off somebody online. I don't know who made it. I just saw it on like Pinterest or something. I was like, I can do that. And I did it. And it's just like a Victorian lady type thing. And so I have that little tiny hoop hanging by my key rack. And then I did a piece my wife and I got married and we went to Montreal for like a sort of abbreviated honeymoon. And we went to the botanical gardens there and they were doing like a nighttime illuminated garden thing. It was gorgeous. And we took this, I took this picture of the gardens, like the Japanese gardens there. And I did like a nighttime embroidery piece, which is really not like in my usual style. And she told me that she would never speak to me again if I sold it. So that's hanging in her room. But I was ready to sell it. Somebody offered me money for it. And I was like, well.
Tough spot there. Yeah.
Yeah. No.
Does she have any interest in needlework?
She loves what I do, but she is a baker by trade.
Oh.
Extreme artisanal baker. She's so talented. And she also does a lot of sculpty stuff. So she makes these like little miniatures and everything, which are so cool, but she does not do needlework. No.
Ooh, a skilled baker in the house. Ooh.
Oh man.
That's dangerous. Oh, the smells all the time. That's dangerous stuff there.
She doesn't bake as much at home. No. She right now works for two restaurants here in New Haven. She's the head pastry chef for two really great restaurants. So she bakes there, you know, and so she cooks at home, but she doesn't bake as much. She's so used to having like an industrial kitchen with industrial equipment that when she comes home, she's like, she'll just bring stuff from wherever she's working. But
that phrase, did you save room for dessert? Damn right I did.
Oh my gosh. Get it. If I always save room for dessert.
Ooh, that, there we go. I just enjoyed so many, all the different displays of, in your website of your art. The gaze section with all of your eye pieces is so fascinating to me what people can do with eyes. You know, and just that one organ in the body has so much expression in so many different ways. Is there a therapeutic thing there, or is it just for you?
You know, I don't know. Yeah. I haven't made the eyes for a while either. I make them every now and then. It's kind of like the other more abstract ones where every now and then I just am like, oh, I'm going to do this because I love making them. I feel like eyes, you know, there's like certain iconographic like symbols and things that get really popular. So like for a while it was like cactuses, and it's still like cactuses and succulents, and you see them on like a lot of kits and stuff. And I feel like eyes are definitely in that category too, where I just see them on a lot of things. But every culture I think probably has some kind of like eye, you know, or mythology around eyes. And so I started making them just because I wanted to make one, I believe is how it started. I was like, oh, I'm going to make an eye. And then at the same time I was reading through, this website, I think it's a book now. I don't remember the guy's name sadly, but it's the Dictionary of Obscure Sorrows. And so I was like thinking, using that as like different entries in these, what it is basically just like an encyclopedia of fake words, I guess is the word.
Okay.
To describe feelings that we don't have words for in English. So there are a lot of like, you'll say, you know, you'll be like, oh, in German, they have this word for this feeling, and we don't have a translation for that in English. And so he makes this whole list of like fake words that would describe feelings that we don't actually have words for in English. So then they're no longer really fake words, but so it was going through those and just kind of, this was again when I first was like getting sober and was pretty depressed, and used that as the basis for like making these different eyes, just to kind of give them a thematic thread through them. But mostly I just like making them. I'm like, there's something satisfying about it. And I can track like how much better I've gotten at embroidery through them too. Like the first ones are pretty like kind of sad. And then as I get better, I'm like, oh, this is also like doing the same thing over and over again and seeing your progress is really satisfying. So,
yeah. Yeah. Back to the alcohol thing, as you're getting through that, you decide, all right, I'm going to be sober doing the AA.
Yeah.
Is when you want to drink, did you have to teach yourself, grab the needle and thread?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, one of the things, you know, they tell you in recovery and 12-step programs is always like, keep your hands busy, right? Like, and in the classic big book in AA, there's like a, it was funny to me, I don't remember which story it was, but there are all these stories, and like, cruel work is suggested as one of the things to keep you from drinking. But I started embroidering first and then got sober, but it absolutely helped. Like, no doubt about it. Like, and I used to embroider through, I don't really go to AA meetings very often anymore, but when I was really active in recovery circles, like, I went to every meeting with embroidery hoops in my hand. It's just like knitting, you know, and people would knit through meetings too, where you just need something to still the anxiety. So,
yeah. Okay. Like, that was a random left turn, but I was just curious about that.
That's all connected.
Yeah. All right. Back to the art, the music.
Yeah.
Music. Okay. The Boston album cover.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that album. Oh, man. And you know, we just moved like a year and a half ago, and I had, they used to have, wood crates for, what was it, the 16-ounce bottles when they were glass bottles of soda. And
yeah.
I had two of those wooden crates full of albums. And
yeah.
No turntable, and I hadn't used them in years. They were in storage, and I sold them.
Yeah.
Because I'm not hauling, you know, they weigh a ton. I got no place.
No, I sold so many albums over the years.
And when you talked about that and your about getting rid of your albums, I have to say I had a moment where, oh, I wish I'd kept those albums.
Oh.
Cuz the Boston album was one of them, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, Elton John, you know, so many of the classics, and the guy I sold them to, I'm sure that I saw in his eye as he was looking through, cuz he just took the whole lot for $100. And I'm sure when he looked through that there were a couple that caught his eye that he knew were, you know, valuable.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like, oh, what did I give away? But yeah, there's just, yeah.
So I did, I think, yeah, you're referring to me talking about, in the music, bit about how many records I had sold. Again, when I moved for grad school, I, sold all my, I had a very large yard sale. I lived in Portland, Maine, right on Congress Street. For anyone who's ever been to Portland, it was on the East End, right by the fire department and the observatory, and it's just a very high traffic area. And so I had this giant yard sale where everyone was like, woo, records and art supplies. And so I sold a ton of albums that had been my dad's, but I did keep the Boston record, and I did keep Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. So I had like four or five that I was like, these are sentimental, you know, to me, and I'm going to keep them just to have them. Cause if my father had not passed away when he did, when I was so young, I probably would have not have felt as attached to them as I did at that time.
Yeah.
Cause I didn't have a lot of his stuff. And so I kept that one. And then, yeah, I tend to do like, I didn't do one this year. I think I was too busy this spring, but most years I tend to, around the anniversary of his death, which is in April, I tend to do like a memorial piece, just something fun for myself, that I'm not trying to sell, or anything like that. And so a couple of years ago, I did the logo for Anderson Windows because he was a carpenter and we had a lumberyard, and like that sticker was just like all over everything.
Yep.
So it was just really recognizable. And I was like, I didn't have a lot of time. I was like, I'm going to stitch up. I like doing like replicas of things. I just did a pat of butter that my friend sent me a picture of it being funny. And I just like made it as an embroidery piece. So I like doing these like little one-off things where you're just kind of mimicking or making miniatures of, or in this case, like the butter case of blow up of the butter pat. But
yeah.
So I did that. And then the year after that, I was like, I am going to do the Boston album cover because my dad loved Boston. And I just remember him being like nerding out with his sound system, like men tended to do in the 70s and the 80s, and be like talking about it being a studio album and like, you know, like yeah. Studio yeah. technology. And it was so fun to make. And it was a real challenge. Like the perspective on that album, like when you really look at the image, it's like a guitar spaceship and like the perspective is really skewed. And the artist who, I don't remember the artist's name, who actually drew that album cover, they don't even really get it right. Like when you're looking at the album cover, you're like, wow, that's not that great. Like you kind of screwed it up.
Yeah. But it's such like, it's such a classic.
Totally.
You know, you recognize it. You don't even need the word Boston on it. Just know it.
Yep.
And that group, and it was the music, it was just so groundbreaking at the time. Those songs you could listen to forever.
And I'm shocked. Like, so it is that one I do have for sale. And sometimes I'll do like art fairs and stuff. And it's been up on my table, but it's a little bit out of the price point for those kinds of things. But I'm shocked by like how many young people walk by and they know it.
Sure.
This is incredible. Like I'm starting to get to the age where like the audience for my cultural references are like not 20 anymore. Like when a 20-year-old walks by and they're like, whoa, that's the Boston cover. I'm like, how do you know that? But like they do. It's just that like iconic.
Yeah, that they talk about one hit wonders, and you know that they had a couple of other albums, but nothing that reached that did. And you know, that's kind of a one hit album, but oh yeah, through the years, I mean, that music holds up and will always hold up. It's just so powerful.
It's so good.
Yeah. And then, Owen, I have to talk about, now you do a show, a radio show, Love and Communication on WPKN.
Yes.
Okay. So I found that and all right, I'm going to see what your show's like. So I put it on while I'm researching you in the background.
Uh-huh.
And the first one I put on is the September 16 show.
Yes.
And you lead off with Elton John's Funeral for a Friend. And I'm telling you, you had me right there.
So I started programming for WPKN probably, I guess, like 3 or 4. Maybe it's even been 4 years now. I had a friend. She works at Yale. She's an artist. She and I would talk about shows I was going to. I love live music. I'm just always kind of at smaller venues around New Haven. And she was like, you should program. And I was like, okay, cool. And I always wanted to have a radio show when I was like in high school but it just seemed so far out of reach. And she really just kind of took me in and showed me how to use the board. And Love and Communication is, most people think it's like a call-in show because of the name, but I named it after a song by Cat Power. The song's called Love and Communication. It's kind of my theme song that I kick off with each month. And so I just do it once a month. It's late at night, but that's kind of a pain, but it's also better because you don't have to scan. There are different FCC rules for what kinds of songs you can play on the radio after 10. So I don't have to scan every song for, you know, a mild curse word even. So the 16th of September, there was a music piece that I made that's similar to the alcohol piece that is, I called it a brief history of how music made me queer. And so I went through like from birth through now, like all the different songs that I loved growing up and how I coded them a little bit differently, for like my gay desire or like.
Yeah, I gotta interrupt you there because that was an interesting thing that you said on that show that gay people, and again, I apologize if I don't use the terms right, but
yeah, I know. I think there's some resistance to saying queer, even though I refer to myself as queer, and that's totally fine. I understand that like people are like, I don't want to say queer because that's a slur to.
That's the way I was brought up, so I have trouble with it. Yeah. But so tell me about that codifying and adjusting, because like Funeral for a Friend, there's Elton John's gay, but there's nothing gay about that. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So I don't think every song that I included on that piece or that I put on the show that I kind of like programmed to go along with it, not every one of them is like a love song for like someone of the opposite gender. So it wasn't really so much about that, but there was just like hints of gayness or what LGBT culture that like I would not have recognized as such growing up, but somewhere inside me I must have sort of recognized it as such. And so a lot of the songs on there, it's like, oh, I can see now like my my childhood self was like looking for representation, and you have to find it in like these really strange places, or you sense that there's just something different about that person or that artist or that, you know, song or whatever. And so funeral for a friend, I think like I was too young to even have any sense of like what my sexual orientation was. I was like 4, but like, but like, there was just something so dramatic and like longing about that song. And as I said, in the music, the WPKN show that I did, like, you know, this was before AIDS, but like, it seems almost prophetic, you know, knowing like in hindsight, like what was going to come in the '80s when I was hearing that song. And at the like height of the AIDS crisis and like not really having a sense of what that meant, and that like gay men were especially dying, and like, so, and just the flair of it. Like, I don't think that gay men have a corner on flamboyance. Like, I am super, super dramatic. I am very, like, I talk a lot. I'm loud. My embroideries are like very, like you said, there's bold colors. So like, there's something about the dramatic, like, performance of Elton John that like people love, but like, I really, really like just felt so drawn to as a kid. So that kind of stuff, like, even, you know, I don't think I played Dude Looks Like a Lady on the show, but it's in the piece that I made. You know, like Steven Tyler in that video, I'm 8 years old, and you see the video and they turn around and it's this guy in a wedding dress and a woman in a tuxedo. And my little 8-year-old brain was just like, what is going on here?
Yeah.
Really, really loved that kind of play on gender and anything dramatic and flamboyant. I just was immediately drawn to. So,
yeah. Well, you got me with that one, because and it was so strange, because I have said to my wife more than once, I just think it's one of the greatest songs ever done.
Yes.
And I've said to her, you know, I want that played at my funeral. And then when I read that you had also said that you wanted it at your funeral, because it's just, I just love that song. I've listened to it, you know, billions of times. And,
And that's what I love. Like, how on earth would, you know, and so the show is up in Portland, the piece is up in Portland, and I was talking to a guy there, his name's Smith, Tanner, I believe is his last name. He's a photographer. He does a ton of photography, documentary projects up in Portland. And I think he also lives in like Boston or something, but, he just was like, we don't have anything besides being gay really in common from what I can tell. But he was just like, these songs mean so much to me. And like, it's so cool to see them in this piece, because it's just, and that's what I love about it. It's like, even though I'm saying these are all the songs that like helped me see myself as like a gay person in the universe, like it's just so cool to me that like the power of pop culture even to be like a unifying factor across like age and difference. Like, who would think that you and I both want to have funeral for our friends, like played at our funeral, but like, that's a really cool connection that has now been forged because of Elton John and our mutual love for Fiber. Right. Like, so cool. It's so cool.
Oh, that song. I'll tell you, I mean, I have been through it. I've listened to just the drum track, just the guitar. You know,
that's awesome. I love that.
Yep. And when you played it, I was researching you. I when that came on, I just stopped because I had to listen to the song. It's like, out of respect to Elton John and that song, I have to listen with nothing else. Yeah,
I will get off this call and I will listen to it in its entirety.
Yeah, it's got to be loud. It's got to be loud, and all the things.
Yep.
All right, we're gonna run out of time.
Yes.
Keb Mo's Oklahoma album cover art. Tell me about that experience.
That was wild. It was so cool. And they were so nice. So he had like an art agent, and I got like a voicemail. And I was like, who tracked me down? Like, who's calling me? You know, I'm pretty skeptical with the cell phone now. If anybody calls, you see a number you don't recognize. Like, half the time I don't even listen to the message, 'cause I'm like, it's just a spam call.
Right.
And so, he had an art agent who was looking for me or was looking for embroidery work and came across something on Instagram that I had done, which was a stitch a day piece where I had done this large like circle a few years ago. I think it was like 2017, where every single day I asked somebody, one of my followers, to make a suggestion for me to stitch for that day. And people got really into it because they wanted to be picked, right?
Yeah.
And they wanted to see like their suggestion make it into this hoop. So I started in the center on like January 1st. And for the entire year, every day I added a whatever one of the suggestions was. Sometimes it was a feeling that I had to interpret. Sometimes it was like an object that you could actually embroider. And I'd have multiple entries. So I would take them and I would number them like one through whatever. And then I would type the like, draw a random number, like from a random, you know, whatever number generator. So right. That one that I would add so that people would feel like it was fair. Even though I could have easily lied, and maybe I did a couple of times because I didn't want to do the one that for the most part, it was,
hey, it's art. You're entitled, right? Whatever.
Yeah. Or I'm like, I got 10 minutes. I can't do Frida Kahlo today. So I had made this big piece and it was, it's just so much fun and like such a cool way to experience like what can be good about social media and like not just negative. It was just such a fun project. And she had seen that and she wanted to know if it was still available because they wanted to use that as the back of his album behind him. And it was, I had already sold it and I was like, no, it's sold. She was like, well, what if he gives you a list of all of his favorite things and you can just recreate those in no time at all, right?
Yeah, right.
And so I was like, bring it on, I guess. So they sent me a list of things.
So back up a little bit. So they really wanted that piece then, if they're going to have you create another one. Wow.
Yep. So I was like, it's in Canada. The person who bought it lives like in Saskatchewan. Like, we're not getting that back for this. and I don't have any images that are high quality enough for that, you know? So they paid me to stitch up, his pieces. And then basically I just like sold the rights to everything. They wouldn't, they're savvy business people and they know they're dealing with someone who doesn't know what she's doing. So, I negotiated into what felt like a fair price for the images that he wanted. And they were Kev Mo and his wife, who is like his, basically like his business manager, are just like lovely, lovely, lovely people. So nice. So like, you see so much album art and like, you have no idea who made it and you have to go digging, and they let me keep my signature on the front and on the back of the album. It's got like the credits and it says embroidery by Michelle Morgan, like, oh, right there with everybody else, which,
oh, honestly, that's cool.
It's just not like, it never happens. You have to really like dig to find, you know, who the artist is. And so they really did like honor that part of the packaging, I guess you could say. And then they used all the little designs. So while that album was out, when it was his most recent release, like they used it for like socks and like, so my wife has a pair of socks with all the, like they used the designs for other merchandise, which, wow, was kind of fun. And then it won a Grammy. So my whole family and like everybody I know was just like, kind of for a minute, we're like, what the hell? How did you get, like you'd go on like Amazon the day it was released and like, there it is. It was the coolest experience just to see your artwork kind of like all over something. And I would love to do more stuff like that, but you know, there's not a giant, I wish there was more of a market. I wish people would think of embroidery and needlework as like illustrative and graphic.
Yeah.
You know, the graphic possibilities for that are just like endless. But people don't really think about it. That's not their first go-to when they think about album art, you know?
Right. Well, with vinyl coming back, you know, we may see more of that, because at one point album art was its own art form.
Yes,
I mean, totally. That was, you know, someone came out with an album, we were almost as interested in the art and how it was put together as we were in the music itself. I mean, I remember Alice Cooper's School's Out.
Yep.
Where it folded into a desk and, you know, there's so many cool things. Chicago at Carnegie Hall, that four album set with that giant poster, and
so there's this rock band right now, Built to Spill. They've been around for a while, and their album, I love the album that just came out, but the person who did the art, I'm so into it. And then someone bought it and showed me, like, it opens up and everything, and I'm like, I have to buy this album for the art. Like, that's, you will absolutely get me to buy your LP if the artwork is thoughtful, you know?
Right. Well, you know, maybe you'll get more jobs, because, I mean, vinyl is really picking up.
I buy vinyl again. I sold all my albums when I moved, and then once I finished grad school, I was like, I can't keep buying books, like, it's stupid, I can't read them all. And so I transferred that bad purchasing habit into my vinyl habit, which is, my wife calls them squares. She's like, another square arrived on the doorstep for you today. I wonder what it could be.
Maybe even, what is it? Columbia Music, wasn't it? Yeah.
Oh my gosh, yes. I loved tapes.
Oh, that was a dangerous thing to get involved in. Oh, yeah. Expensive, yeah. All right, Michelle, we got to stop. There's another hour of talk, but we got to stop. So,
all right.
Absolutely enjoyed it. Thanks for the time. Thanks for sharing all of these things. Really applaud your embroidery. It is such a treat to look at. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah.
Thanks for letting me talk about myself. I love doing that. It's one of my favorite topics, and I will say yes to any opportunities to wax on and on. So thank you, Gary.
Okay. All right. Thanks. And thanks to everyone for listening.